Hello there, and a warm welcome of a sort to this, the 268th edition of DF2It Weekly. Kind of feels like we've done 268 in the last 2 weeks based on the amount of events we've had to cover, but here we are, back to the regularly numbered Direct, but we are going to kick off by looking at Nintendo Direct. And joining me on the panel, as usual now, since Alex is still out, still recovering, John Linneman, hello.
Hey, Rich. Yeah, I miss Alex a lot. Yeah, I don't know if he'll hear this, but he's a great dude, and it's been empty without him. But I'm glad to have you guys here with me today, because there is a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. And hello, Oliver McKenzie.
Yes, I also miss Alex, and I also miss the days when we weren't doing 5 or 6 of these a week. But I think that's going to be over rather soon, I expect.
Yeah, but before we kick off, first of all, I want to give a shout out to the amazing work that Will Judd is doing over at digitalfoundry.net, our website. If you're part of the supporter program, you'll get that completely ad-free, just like our video downloads. Lots of interesting stories happening there. Arm showing off its neural rendering suite on mobile, which is really, really interesting stuff. Will actually spoke to the developers about that. Do check that out on the site. Next-gen GPU rumor roundup, what's coming from NVIDIA, AMD and Intel, or what we think is happening based on rumors. And there's been a lot of them happening in the follow-up to Computex there. Will reviewed a $90 8K Pro controller. That's kind of like 8K refresh rate, polling rate, I suspect. It's not designed for a display resolution. $90, but he reckons it's worth it's as good as alternatives that are twice the cost. And apparently we did indeed have our first showing or reveal of Intel's Z990 motherboard at Computex. Now, there's a lot of great stuff hopefully happening with Intel with its next generation CPU. So that's worth checking out as well. But that's all from us on that particular front. There's plenty of other stuff to check out there as well. Okay, so let's do it. Let's talk about Nintendo Direct, the last big event of the summer showcase season. I think there was a general level of disappointment based on what was actually shown there. And there was one big game that we were really looking forward to seeing but barely saw anything of. Oliver, you decided to take it upon yourself to choose the highlights of the show. And I guess we should start with Ocarina of Time, right?
Yeah, Ocarina of Time, interesting showing. I think the disappointment here that John, or rather that Rich was mentioning, lies in the fact that this game is a title that was kind of heavily rumored. It's not really a big surprise. And a leaker, Nate the Hate, was talking about this some months ago. And it's been basically accepted wisdom that this game would come out at some point in the near future. And despite all that, Nintendo was revealing it with kind of all the panache of a developer, a publisher that was revealing a game for the first time when we already knew about this title. So they really didn't show us too much here, unfortunately. Really just a couple seconds, if I count it out now. We have like 15 seconds of what appears to be in-game real-time rendered footage. And then a brief interstitial showing like a tapestry before then. So nothing too exciting here. But what they did show looks good. You know, I saw a lot of people remark that Nintendo hired this man, and perhaps that's not quite fair. I think this does look quite attractive. In this limited chunk of footage, we see Link sleeping, kind of like the beginning of the game, although there are some indications that maybe they've mixed things up a little bit, just with respect to some symbolism here. But he's sleeping. He's not cel-shaded, but he's obviously quite stylized. No TAA, no DLSS, which makes me think this might be an internally developed title, because that's kind of like the visual signature of Nintendo so far this generation. It's running at 60 FPS, appears to be 1440p in this footage based on some pixel counts, or maybe about 1440p, maybe slightly higher than 1440p. Quite an easy count, actually, with no AA or very limited post-AA or something like that. Quite pleasing, but I really want to see more. Like, that's the big takeaway here. I really don't know where they would go with a remake. Would they make it open world? God forbid. Would they remix things? Would they basically just deliver a visual remake of the title in line with some other efforts that we've seen from other developers where they really don't touch the original gameplay, kind of like The Last of Us Part 1?
Right.
It's not quite clear. If it's Nintendo internal, I kind of suspect maybe they'd make more changes. If it's external, I would expect them to make fewer changes. But yeah, very curious to see where this one goes. But I really want to see more footage. And it feels really weird because they're announcing the title for 2026. There's only 6 months left in 2026. But they're not announcing a date or showing any gameplay or anything like that. Like, it just seems like a weird way to announce the title.
Interesting. We've actually got this supporter question, which raises many similar questions. Spodlood asks, hello, DF crew. I'm intrigued to hear your predictions for OOT. Do you think it will be a pretty standard remake like Grezzo did on the 3DS or more of a reimagining? Nintendo tend to not change the formula, right? The return of Woohoo Island and the countless remakes of Star Fox prove this, don't they? Do they, John?
So that is an interesting point, because by and large, when Nintendo does remake games, they tend to stay pretty true to the original formula. But I feel like in the case of Ocarina of Time, if they were to just stick with the original game design as it is, or as we saw in the 3DS version, we would end up with a situation similar to, and possibly even more egregious than, Metal Gear Solid 3 Delta. Which I don't dislike Delta, but there's this weird disconnect with it where, like, all the underlying animation, gameplay, map designs, everything about it is the PS2 game. But then they've stuck this, like, super high-end visual presentation on top of it. And it's not bad, but it makes it feel weird to me. I never quite liked that. And, you know, keeping an older engine running beneath the surface is not necessarily something that's an issue. Like Shadow of the Colossus and Demon Souls from Bluepoint, those games had enough like pizzazz in the general movement and design that it actually worked. But I don't think it would work here. And since they've already done the 3DS version of Ocarina of Time, I feel like it needs to be something a little bit more robust. And I don't think we really have a good blueprint for what that looks like under Nintendo, right? Can you guys think of anything that they've done where they've remade a game and it's significantly different from an original? I mean, the closest thing that I can think of off the top of my head that they published but didn't develop was Silicon Knights' Metal Gear Solid The Twin Snakes, which was indeed quite different from the original in many, many ways. But that's not really a Nintendo game in the truest sense, so I'm not really sure if there is an example of this.
Nothing springs to mind. I don't know what you think, Oliver.
No, nothing really springs to mind at the moment. I mean, there are some titles that have been upgraded enormously visually, like Link's Awakening would be one, right, that we saw in 2019. But I'm not really sure. I mean, and Nintendo tends to add, when they do go back to older titles, they tend to add more convenience features, right? It's like when we saw the Ocarina of Time 3D remake back in 2011, they added like some hint system to the game to smooth your experience with the title if you wanted to go back to the home and see some hints for how you might progress. But in general, they don't really mess too much with things. The only thing that I would think is maybe pushing me in that direction is I think some people who are more in tune with the series than I am have pointed out some possible incongruities with this sequence and a similar sequence to the Nintendo 64 game in the Ocarina of Time remake as well, that suggests maybe they're messing up the timeline a little bit with this title. But also, if it is a Nintendo first-party title, which we have a scant evidence to suggest, but perhaps it is, then maybe they would feel a little bit more freedom to go back and actually change things. I'm not quite sure.
Interesting. Well, famously, I've never played this game. It launched in a period where I just wasn't a part of Nintendo whatsoever, and I never kind of circled back to it. I was just looking at some footage now, and obviously it's a game of its era, and I suspect that just producing the kind of visuals that were hinted at in this, I'm not even going to call it a trailer because it wasn't really, was it? I think it's just going to be a full visual revamp, and what more do you kind of want from that? I mean, wasn't the original like 20 frames per second as well, with very, very basic to judge by today's standards graphics? So I think that would kind of be enough. I mean, what I don't know about it is certainly made up for by the fact that people absolutely love it, the people that have played it. So I'm not really sure there's much to be gained from going beyond that. Maybe some sort of flourishes and stuff like that. I don't know. I mean, this is the big tease, right? Obviously, if it is indeed going to be coming 2026, we're going to be finding out more about it quite soon. Shall we move on? Shall we talk about Xenoblade? Because we saw new releases there, Oliver.
Yeah, yes, there are a variety of titles in the mix here. Probably the first and most exciting of these geez, I guess it's four games that we're talking about in the Xenoblade saga is Xenoblade Genesis, which I think looks very good. I love the character models. It's very clean and pleasing with good cell shading on the character models. And the environments as well look quite good. I think they have very striking lighting, like in that kind of interior sequence that we see here in the school or cathedral or whatever it is. Definitely looks a cut above the other Xenoblade titles and doesn't exhibit some of the more worrying kind of like texture tiling and things like that we've seen in the other Xenoblade titles necessarily. Looks quite clean, looks quite good. Very pleasing open world title. Some aliasing here there. It kind of looks a little bit like DLSS Lite almost to me because the way that it has very clean edges in stationary shots, but in motion it's a bit more compromised. I did count out one shot and it's 1440p, roughly speaking. I counted a couple edges on one shot, so appears to be a 1440p 30 title, which is no great surprise. In terms of the Xenoblade Chronicles Switch 2 editions, those are the other titles we're talking about. So basically they're going back and issuing Switch 2 editions for Xenoblade Chronicles 1, 2, and 3. All those titles that originally appeared on Switch. Xenoblade Chronicles 1 was a Wii title, a 3DS title, and then a Switch title with a number of graphical enhancements. And that's actually a title that I took a look at because they released that game. That's the first of the three titles they're releasing here. And it actually looks quite good. It's very clean, crisp, pleasing, nice to look at. Not at all like Xenoblade Chronicles X, which as I'm sure John can remark, looked very ugly and upscaled and super messy. I actually counted it out at 720p internally for Xenoblade Chronicles 1. So it is being upsampled, presumably with something like DLSS, which there is some evidence of on the edge artifacts that we see here. So I'm quite pleased by this game. And yeah, it's definitely nice to see a good 60 FPS update of a Xenoblade Chronicles title that isn't compromised massively in terms of image quality. So yeah, across the board, I think Monolith Soft delivers some of the best Switch experiences in terms of their technical output. And these titles look to be reclaiming that crown after kind of slipping a bit with Xenoblade Chronicles X, which was kind of a messy title on Switch too, I would say.
reclaiming their reputation a bit. I mean, it's a world of difference to my eyes based on what we saw from the prior game. John, thoughts?
Yeah, no, this is one of the few games here at the Direct that actually was exciting. I do like Xenoblade Chronicles. And I do think this new one, Genesis, looks quite excellent. I like the visual design. I'm a big fan of that sort of curved world design, right? It's similar, I guess, in concept to Halo or like the world from Zone of the Enders, where, you know, it's just like you traverse it, but you're like moving along it in a way as if it rises up against the horizon.
Right.
And I hope that there's a way to actually seamlessly traverse the world in that sense, right? Rather than dividing it up into like different loading districts, which we don't yet know how it's going to play out. But I also like character designs. The animation with the terrain is better. I think Xenoblade 1 and 2 always, I never liked the way the games looked in motion because especially with Shulk, he's basically got Kingdom Hearts shoes on. It's the way I've always looked at it, like big floppy feet, and it just looks dumb running around the world. It never felt good to me. And I actually think getting that run cycle down is something that helps make a game feel good just to pick up and play. And they've definitely improved. Xenoblade Chronicles 3 was already a step up in that direction. So the upgrades, I haven't really looked closely. Somebody did mention to me, though, that Xenoblade 1 has some weird performance hiccups. Mm-hmm. Did you see anything, Oliver?
I saw it drop frames a few times. I was really just in the initial area, honestly. I tested it out for like 15 minutes just to see how it was. So in terms of image quality, I think it looks quite attractive. In terms of performance, that's harder to judge without like later game content, I would expect.
Okay, well, so yeah, I mean, that's good stuff. I'm excited for those games for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Oliver, so Star Fox was part of the presentation there. There is actually a playable demo out now. You've taken a quick look at it, right?
Yeah, just a quick look. Obviously, we have this game is coming in pretty soon. I think it's a June 25th release date, if I'm not mistaken, if my memory isn't failing me too badly here. But yeah, it's very pleasing. It's a lot of the same content we've seen in prior Nintendo showings of this title in the Direct, but I think it looks awesome. The cutscenes look terrific. The gameplay looks great. I was able to do a little bit more pixel counting with this title just to get some preliminary counts in the mix here. And in cutscenes, it is counting at 1080p. Which is kind of to be expected. That's kind of where I think we had counted the game earlier in gameplay. And the gameplay also counts at 1080p in my counts. But interestingly, there is this divide between the cutscenes, which seem to be using some temporal image treatment, possibly DLSS or something, look very clean, very crisp, but 30 FPS. And then the gameplay, which is 60 FPS, but seems to be going along with more of that kind of Nintendo styling of not actually using much image treatment. If any at all, it seems to maybe be using, I think it's using a post AA is my guess, based off of the image quality characteristics that we do see in these sequences. Beyond that, looks quite pleasing. I wish we saw a more lengthy demo, perhaps, because this is a very brief snippet of gameplay, unfortunately, without too much in the way of, like, I would have loved to see some segments in Corneria. Right, some of the early missions there, we just get like the sequence in the meteorite field, which is not that great. And then also, I think perhaps more interesting to us than any of those like preliminary technical details is the fact that this title has been confirmed to be using an external developer, Velen Studios. They also developed Knockout City, which was that kind of like, I think it's now discontinued, but that kind of MMO style title. Mario Kart Live Home Circuit as well, another Nintendo title. Hot Wheels Rift Rally, a number of other games, and they're using their own internal game engine, which is called Viper, which is pretty cool. So this is, I guess we're kind of right in part in the sense that it is using proprietary technology, but wrong in the sense that it's not a Nintendo-developed title, which I think we're kind of looking forward to because this game does exhibit some characteristics that would make it pretty tantalizing technologically for other Nintendo-developed titles down the road, right? But it turns out this is internal technology at Velen. It's not a internal Nintendo title or an Nintendo internal first-party engine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so John, you're very keen to review this. What do you want from this game?
Well, we know that it is a straightforward remake, but I guess the most interesting thing to me is just the way they expand the story stuff outward, because getting a little bit more of that in there. The original game did not have like proper cutscenes in the same sense, outside of a couple little segments, so I like that addition. And it's just one of those classic games. It's fun to revisit many times over. So, and it is designed to be replayed multiple times because a single playthrough is pretty short, I would say, which is fine. It's like a Panzer Dragoon game in that regard.
Right.
Mm-hmm. but there's many different paths and secrets and all kinds of stuff to find. And so I'm just in it for the additional story stuff and the presentation, the visuals. And it's cool to learn that it is like their own internal engine because of everything that Nintendo first party has released on the console. It's one of the best looking things we've seen yet by far, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. It feels technically impressive to me.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Well, going to have a review on that soon, hopefully. Oliver, let's return to your selected highlights. Kingdom Hearts. Lots of Kingdom Hearts.
Kingdom Hearts. So perhaps the standout here is our first gameplay of Kingdom Hearts 4, which was announced a number of years ago. Obviously, the Kingdom Hearts franchise, long-running. Kingdom Hearts 3, I think, came out in 2019, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 2018. This title has been along in incubation since then, but I think it looks pretty good here. They appear to be targeting a 60 FPS target on Switch 2, which is quite good. I didn't get a pixel count on this, but it seems quite clearly low resolution, maybe some reconstruction artifacts in the mix, some messy looking SSR, things like that. But 60 FPS on Switch 2 for a current generation title, pretty cool. Some of the city environments do look a little bit bare. I wonder if that might be touched up a little bit on some of the bigger consoles in terms of their lighting presentation or asset detail or anything like that. But the cutscenes look quite terrific here. So some good signs there for Kingdom Hearts 4. They are also releasing Kingdom Hearts 1 to 3 on Switch 2, which I'm glad those are getting a Switch 2 port. And the first two titles are coming to Switch 1 as well. If you might recall, there was a Kingdom Hearts 1 to 3 Cloud Edition for Switch 1, which released some years ago, but that did not include any, obviously, native rendering on device itself. It was all in the cloud. And I don't know, it's kind of bittersweet because I'm glad that they're coming back and reintroducing those titles running natively on Switch 1 and Switch 2. That's terrific. But they're discontinuing the Switch 1 edition, the Switch 1 Cloud Edition, which is, you know, maybe fine, but they're also pulling the server support for those titles in 2027. So it really does indicate when you buy these cloud editions on Switch or Switch 2 or whatever, you really don't know what you're getting into, right? And in some cases, they can pull support for those games sooner than expected. I think having support for those titles for only 1 year past the delisting date, I think is probably not a reasonable way to go here.
No, that's kind of crazy. On the one hand, I'm kind of glad it's going, because whenever we've tested it, it's just been awful. I can't believe that it was sustainable. On the other hand, if people have bought it, they deserve something for their time, for their money, basically. John, Kingdom Hearts.
So actually, weirdly, one of the things about this that caught my attention is like the technical presentation of the Direct. If you actually watch the Direct as they showed it, it was broadcast at 60 frames per second, and there was 60 FPS content in there. And in fact, the logo for Kingdom Hearts 4, which is part of the video, is 60 frames per second. But guess what? The gameplay and everything shown in that version of the trailer is all 30. Yet you guys were saying like, oh no, it looks like 60, but that's only in the dedicated Kingdom Hearts 4 trailer. So I was like, wait, did they mess it up? Like, clearly they delivered a 60 FPS asset because the logo for the game is 60, right? So it's not like they uploaded a 30 FPS trailer. But why the difference? Right. Is it other console footage? Like, what's going on? Like, I really don't know, because on Nintendo's official website or YouTube channel, they have the 60 FPS version of the game trailer. So
that's
really baffling to me. And it's funny that they would show it at 60, because from what I've seen, Kingdom Hearts 3 on Switch absolutely does not run at 60. It's quite bad. So I would genuinely be shocked if they were able to get Kingdom Hearts 4 running at a stable 60 on Switch 2 when Kingdom Hearts 3 can't even do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because now I'm pressing the frame by frame buttons on the YouTube trailer, and it looks like the standalone trailer, the initial cinematic, is 30, and then and then it swaps to 60. That's kind of weird, isn't it?
It's extremely weird. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what's up with it, but
it definitely does look like plausibly rough and aliased, and it has issues. But I would concur with John that I would be a little surprised to see a title like this hit 60 FPS on Switch 2, unless it's been architected from the ground up to be a 60 FPS.
But it's
Switch
Unreal Engine 5, and it's using
right
those types of features, and I just don't believe that they're gonna so easily.
Well, we don't know what features they're using yet, right? But
true.
Otherwise, yeah.
We would need to look. I do see SSR, it looks like, so it could just be that. And who knows about the lighting. So we'll see. Like, maybe it'll surprise us. And that actually brings us to this the third-party aspect of this show, actually. In that, as somebody that owns all platforms, it was a bit unexciting for me, but I can see why some folks would be excited. Like, they basically showed 8 games that already exist on other platforms and are getting ports, and then six games that are upcoming that are going to be on other platforms as well. But hey, it does show third-party support. But the one that stood out actually was Dragon's Dogma 2 Dark Arisen. Not only because it's like the Dark Arisen version, but when we first started talking about Switch 2, we admittedly underestimated that it could actually handle this game. And I maintain that the original Dragon's Dogma 2 that was released probably would not run well on Switch 2, but Capcom has continued to update and improve the game, and I can see that they've obviously made changes then that allow them to now target Switch 2 as well, and that's cool to see. The thing is like the original Dogma 2 was really not well received, especially in Japan. People were really bummed out by it. So, and it was the same actually with Monster Hunter Wild. So, like, Capcom's mostly had hits this gen, but these two games fell short. But this is their chance to sort of redeem themselves. And I think that may indeed be possible. I hope so. I'd like to see it, because conceptually, there's still a lot of good stuff going on. And, you know, the update of the original Dragon's Dogma also arguably got better, so we've been here before. But yeah, I'm happy to see that. And other RE Engine games, of course, Onimusha was announced for the Switch 2. And now I'm skeptical, because that was also shown running at 30 FPS in the Direct trailer. But could it actually be 60? Like, I don't know. Like, now I don't know if I trust what the director is showing us. You know what I mean?
Well,
like we've written... oh, no.
I would like to direct your attention to the 24-second mark in the Dragon's Dogma 2 Dark Arisen trailer, the standalone trailer.
Okay.
And again, move frame by frame. And it's 60 frames per second, but it really does look like frame gen. Sorry.
I suspect this title is unlocked, right? Because it is 60 FPS in some portions and like 40 to 60.
Oh, you're right. So look at this. You're right. The discoveries continue, Rich. I brought up the official one on the Nintendo UK channel, and sure enough, it is like an uncapped frame rate. I can just see by eye, whereas the direct itself. So let me go to Onimusha for Switch 2 trailer. We're doing this live, folks, because this is a discovery. All right, so here it is. Nintendo of America, Way of the Sword, just the Onimusha trailer. What do we got? Okay, that trailer is still presenting at 30. It's a 4K 60 upload, but that's 30. So that actually might just be 30 FPS, which would be interesting because they don't usually cap their games.
Right.
But now, like, we've opened up this can of worms, guys, where, like, you look at this direct and it's like, you know, they showed Stellar Blade, for instance. That's coming to Switch. I love Stellar Blade. But that was shown at 30 FPS. So now it's like, wait, I need to go check out the trailer. Well, actually, no, that looks uncapped on the direct. My bad.
Right.
It was uncapped when I looked at it. Yeah. Yeah.
So so that one's actually correct. It's just uncapped and not.
I think it's just Kingdom Hearts. That's possibly a problem there. But
Kingdom Hearts and Dark Arisen, because Dragon's Dogma also doesn't.
Was it 30 FPS in the direct on there?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It looks choppier pedal to me.
Yeah, I would also, I'd certainly echo John's thoughts there, but I'd have a concern overall here with, like, I am happy they're bringing Dragon's Dogma 2 to Switch. I'm less happy that it seems to have a very inconsistent performance level that's, like, all over the place in line with other Capcom titles. But, yeah, what do you expect? Well, in this case, it seems to have some sequences that are, like, sub 30 FPS and some that are hitting 60 FPS. So that's not too
actually promising. You're right. This might be okay in the direct. It might just be Kingdom Hearts 4. I'm looking at it again. It's just the performance is so unstable.
Yeah.
It's all over the place. There's also,
like other titles here that I saw that were a little bit unconvincing, Final Fantasy XIV appeared to exhibit some performance issues at times in the footage they did show off, which was not too promising.
Mark Triforce Duddleson, who covered FF14, also noted that it looked and ran very bad in that video. So right. That's not promising. And he is our resident Final Fantasy XIV expert.
Right. And then also Metaphor ReFantasia was shown in this footage, in this set of trailers here. And it appears to be an unlocked frame rate, kind of like PS5 is, but at 1080p resolution it appears to be, and it looks very, very rough. So in general, like I'm very happy that Switch 2 is seeing a lot of third-party support, but in terms of the actual games that are being brought over, I'm seeing a lot of really inconsistent, unpleasant performance trends, possibly with these titles. Again, this is purely software, so you don't want to judge too much. But like you look at a title like Space Marine 2, and it's like, did we really need that on Switch 2? I'm not so sure, especially when performance is going to be maybe not the best in these games. And with Capcom, they have a unique issue, which is this unlocking of frame rates, which I'd love to see addressed in some form. It's not great in a title like Pragmata, which is like 60 FPS sometimes, but mostly 40 to 50 FPS. But with a title like Dragon's Dogma 2, which is much more CPU starved, I suspect it's going to be a much bleaker output there without a 30 FPS lock.
So, yeah, I just want to clarify, there is a weird shot in that Dragon's Dogma trailer where something is happening there that doesn't look right, but the rest of it does look just standard unlock frame rate. John?
I was going to say, I do think, Oliver, stuff like Space Marine 2 is like just interesting from a technical standpoint.
Sure.
And that's I thought about this a little bit. So, like, what makes a port like that interesting or not to me and maybe our audience kind of comes down to the technology behind it. If it's just another Unreal game, for instance, you can kind of presume it's just going to be lowering the usual settings in the specific way that they do and will have performance that's likely not going to be great. And that's, I think, kind of boring. But Space Marine 2, I believe that's their own in-house technology still. It is not Unreal. And that game is doing some pretty cool and different stuff. So in that case, personally, I would find that very interesting because we get to see how they adapt that engine to something like the Switch 2. And so that's kind of where my line is. Like, are they doing something interesting with a port? yes or no. Is it a different engine than something like Unreal? Yes or no. That's kind of what determines. But I will say, you know, it's good for Switch 2 owners, especially at this point with the cost of all the hardware being what it is. If you only have a Switch 2, for instance, then yeah, it's great to have these third-party games on it.
Interesting. Space Marine 2. I didn't know about that one, but man, that is super CPU heavy. So I'm going to be very interested to see what they're doing on that one.
Of course, the biggest announcement, Rich, was Minecraft.
Okay.
It showed they had a segment on freaking Minecraft for some reason, and it wasn't even running smoothly. So I'm completely baffled by that. Okay. I mean, why? It's like, whatever. But there was other good stuff in there. I mean, they showed a little more of the Dusk Bloods, which is that From Software game. That's sort of Bloodborne adjacent aesthetically. So that's looking good, I would say. We've got Thumb Wrestling in Nintendo Switch Sports Resort, and we were given a nice 2 or 3 minute demonstration of that. So if you really like thumb wrestling, Rich, and skateboarding on grass, that game's got you covered. Muramasa is coming back, which is cool, but that's also coming to PC. But that's that was originally a Switch game, or sorry, a Wii game.
Wii?
That then was ported to the Vita, and now we're getting a new version on multiple platforms, including the Switch 2. Okay. So, and then Hello Kitty Party Land.
Okay. I think Tom was particularly excited by that one for some reason.
Yeah, he that was the thing he posted the most about in the Slack channel. So expect coverage from Tom.
Go ahead.
The last thing I noticed, they actually are bringing Devil May Cry 5 to the Switch 2.
Yeah, that's cool.
I love Devil May Cry 5, so that's interesting that it's Capcom mining the back catalog again, right? Mm-hmm. And hey, why not?
Yeah. I'm still waiting for the Control port for Switch 2. I mean, it's got to happen.
You think it'll happen?
Right. Well, you can play it on an iPhone with ray tracing.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, so it should happen.
I'm surprised we haven't seen it yet. So, Oliver, we had Rise of the Tomb Raider shadow dropping after the event. It's playable. You can buy it now. Should we?
Well, that's the question of the hour. I did to test it, I guess. Okay. So that's it's not a vote of confidence on my part. Because I was concerned about this port because Aspyr is the studio handling this one. They also did the Tomb Raider 2013 port to Switch 2 a few months ago, which was very compromised, had some concessions even relative to the PS3 and 360 versions. Not a very good title. And here, I would say this is better, but it still has compromises that are like totally bizarre. So you're missing some visual features relative to PS4. So there's no motion blur, for instance, right? No motion blur whatsoever in the game. There's no shadowing in some instances, like for instance, in this cutscene, like all the small details in the wall behind Lara are unshadowed, like the pins. And in this shot, all the distant shadows for foliage are missing. So it looks very flat and ugly and not very pleasing, lacks depth, I would say. And then in that cutscene earlier, there are also some missing objects, like part of the building in this shot, which is just totally gone, and then the beams in this shot. So it seems like they're missing, like they're just porting these games over and missing a lot of the visual minutiae of what make them look so good on current generation platforms. At least like the hair is similar, the lighting overall is similar, but there are these weird cuts here and there that don't feel totally intentional. I'm not totally sure what their porting process was, but it does not seem like it was rigorous enough, perhaps. Frame rates are okay. It seems to be doing a good enough job at 30 FPS. There's no DLSS here. Seems to be a pretty similar image treatment to the PS4 version of the game. But yeah, it's inferior to PS4 in a few key ways. And the overall visual presentation looks fine, but it's really unfortunate to look at these ports and say, well, it's actually missing some key visual stuff relative to that PS4 version. Not really where you want to be with the Switch 2 version of a game.
John, Rise of the Tomb Raider was a benchmark game for Digital Foundry back in the day. I mean, God knows how many times we covered it. Here it is again.
Exactly. I mean, I don't have too much to say, but this is possibly one of the games I've covered the most on Digital Foundry. And it always felt like just when we thought we were done, a new version would come out.
Yeah.
And after the last version, I thought for sure that it was over. We were not going to be revisiting this game again. But here we are. it's 2026 and there's a new version of Rise of the Tomb Raider. I do want to check it out just out of morbid curiosity at this point. But the thing that really gets me and what I can't not stop laughing over is it's called Rise of the Tomb Raider 20-year celebration.
All right.
Like, I know now where that comes from, but do you know why? Like, when you look at the title, you're thinking like, okay, what are they celebrating?
Well,
what would you think? What would you guess, Rich?
What happened in 2006 then? Tell me.
Well, so at first I was like, wait, 2006 is the first Crystal Dynamics Tomb Raider. So maybe that's what they're celebrating. But it turns out 20-year celebration was the subtitle for the PS4 version released right. in 2016, I think, which was celebrating the 20 years of Tomb Raider. And I think because it's a port of that version, they just left 20-year celebration on the title, despite the fact that it's no longer relevant to what it was originally celebrating. So I guess theoretically they could be celebrating Crystal Dynamics releasing a Tomb Raider game, but I really don't think that's what they're doing. I think this is just, they just left the title alone rather than change it to like 30-year celebration.
Yeah, they're trying to indicate parody, feature parody, with the 20-year celebration version, which has like some new features, co-op, things like that. So I think it's just to indicate that's the version of the game you're getting.
It's pretty dumb, though.
It should be 30-year celebration. I agree. But,
you
know.
Wow.
Oh man, I love it.
Okay, well, that was the last event of the summer showcases in 2026. Although we said that after Xbox, and then more came along, so who knows at this point. But let's move on. So after the Xbox showcase we saw earlier, we actually now have 30 minutes of gameplay from Fable, and certainly interesting stuff, and certainly very different to the presentation we saw at the showcase, which looked like some sort of amazing sort of action adventure. This is kind of like classic Fable, right, John?
It is and it isn't. So what I like here is that it does seem to be more than I expected, building on the promises of the original Fable on technology that can now support that vision. So if you go back to the original game, Peter Molyneux, as usual, was promising the world, and that was one of his most egregious examples. And it made it sound like a game where you could do anything, and it was just like this wide open thing of freedom. For me, this Fable released not that long after I first experienced the glory of the Elder Scrolls Morrowind. And I had this vision of like, wow, Fable's going to be like Morrowind, but with like all this extra stuff you can do. And then it turned out it was just a bunch of loading screens, and like every area in Fable was broken up into tiny little segments,
yeah,
which was crushingly disappointing at the time. And I didn't love the game. The sequels improved upon that, but they never fulfilled that. This actually does seem to, and this is an example where I do think an open world actually makes sense, but this seems to offer a lot of the granular interactions and like life management features that Fable kind of attempted and was originally promising to deliver, but it's actually doing it at scale and with technology that can support all of that. And so I was really surprised and impressed with it. Just how much stuff is going on beneath the surface here. And I'm very curious to see how it all plays out. Because, yeah, all the trailers for this just painted it as more of an action-adventure-y thing. And it was unclear if they were going to sort of retain that original vision. But they've definitely embraced it. And so it seems like it could be a game that combines that sort of like those impressive moments, but with this more life management side of things as well. And boy, you can become, if you want to like just kick the whole town's ass and become like a total criminal and a dirtbag, they have shown in this demo that you can still do that, which is great. So
I did enjoy that. 25 minutes right? of basically trying to manage the town nicely and be a great person to everyone and romance the local shopkeeper. And then at the end, they just start randomly killing people after saving a sentient pig. We call it
yes. the pig. The pig.
The thing is, you know, that was the thing, right? Because some of those alternative choices for Colin's fate look pretty grim.
Right?
Yeah, the pig dies.
And I like that. They're not really shying away from that stuff. It seems like they're really embracing this. You can go totally good or totally evil or somewhere in between. And it is fun to mess with that stuff and see what happens as a result. And it really feels like they are going to try to pull it off. So that's great. And in addition, of course, visually speaking, I think the game looks really nice.
It's
a little bit more back down to earth now that we've seen more of the gameplay, right? But it's still like, I really love the subtle lighting in this game and the detail levels and the characters. I mean, I know it's a different team with a different goal, but I was a little worried about that because, let's be honest, Forza Horizon may have amazing looking cars, but its characters are pretty awful.
Right.
So Playground Games has never demonstrated that they're good with character design and like rendering characters in a game world. But this obviously puts that to bed and they look excellent.
I think, you know, the highlight for me was basically your avatar turns up in this town to investigate weird things going on, and he asks the talking pig about the weird things, and the talking pig says, yeah, nothing crazy going on here. Oliver, what were your thoughts?
It's nice to have this kind of slice of exploration and talking to villagers and stuff like that, because it does indicate what you'll be able to do in this game during your downtime. My kind of concern with these systems is like, how deep do they go? Is this just a game where you can check a lot of boxes and you can have like this little fun social simulation for 30 minutes or an hour and then it becomes kind of tiresome? Or how deep or involved do these gameplay systems go beyond just like the reputation system, changing a few in-game events, things like that? I'd be curious to see how deep it goes, because to me, at least in these kinds of titles, I tend to treat them as like a kind of completionist exercise of like, I want to do all the quests, I want to do all the main story content, I want to complete all the kind of carefully handcrafted and iterated on content in the game. I'm not really so interested in these kinds of social dynamics in titles like this, but this seems really cool. Technically, this is a 30 FPS showing. I don't know whether that's representative of console footage or exactly what it's meaning to represent here. I'd presume this game would have a 60 FPS mode as well. I would definitely agree with John in that sense. I think the lighting is quite attractive in this title, and I'm definitely curious to see how this pans out when it does get released. I think they delayed it apparently to get away from Grand Theft Auto 6. I'm not quite sure the extent to which they needed a little bit more time with this title. I certainly wouldn't blame them for that, but it'll be interesting to see this game when it releases, I think, in early 2027.
Yeah, I think it's a wise move. If they needed more time to do to polish it, absolutely fine. But I also think that, you know, let's say they released before, or indeed after Grand Theft Auto 6, and Grand Theft Auto 6 comes out, then suddenly you've invested like what, six, however many years of development into this, and the audience are going to be very easily tempted away to play GTA 6 instead, and that would be pretty bad. Yeah, I thought this looked pretty good. I thought, actually seeing the game in motion and actually a sort of deep dive into how it all plays out on the sort of micromanagement scale kind of demonstrated to me that it's, you know, I just don't have time for that kind of level of immersion. So I'm going to be really interested to see just going through the quest line, how that all plays out. But, you know, if people want to sit in this world and inhabit it and do all the things you saw in that trailer, that's pretty good. But that last 5 minutes, I just thought, yeah, that's probably going to be me just causing carnage.
The game's very, very British too, which is something they've maintained from the original. I do wish a Patrick Marber would make an appearance, who famously was Peter O'Hanrahan in the day to day. I feel like he would have been perfect in this game.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on. Okay, next news story of the week. Well, this one actually sort of broke a little while earlier. There's been reports that Nintendo is producing a new model of the Switch 2. Now, obviously, we'd love to see new OLED screens and stuff like that, but this one is actually a bit more legally based in nature. The EU is introducing legislation that basically means that mobile devices should have easily replaceable batteries. And they are going to be producing a new version of the Switch 2, which is apparently going to have an easily replaceable bat fee. And I think this is pretty good news, not least for the environment, but also for the fact that it, man, you know, I've watched teardown videos of the Switch 2, and to actually get to the bat fee is a super, super involved process. So the idea that you'll be able to buy a Switch 2 and then, you know, basically if the bat fee starts to fade, replace it easily, I think that's absolutely fantastic. And there's, I think the legislation should indeed cover the Joy-Cons as well, and possibly the Pro Controller. Based on what Nintendo is saying, anything with a BEE product code, a BEE product code, will have a version for the EU which has replaceable batteries, and that would cover the Joy-Cons and the Pro Controller. So hopes are high there. This is a really good initiative, right, John?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's actually an example of legislation that's genuinely beneficial beyond just, you know, any environmental impact. This is more about the right to repair and allowing users to like really own and manage their own equipment, right? These built-in batteries, especially the ones that are difficult to get to, it's a serious problem because batteries do not last forever. And when they do go, not only is there a potential safety hazard in some cases, as far as like expanding and exploding, right? But it also means, you know, your product is dead until you can find a way to replace it. And at least in the case of Switch 1, when there's no battery or no charge to it, the console cannot operate, right? So you need a working battery in there, which is something I worried about for the longevity of these systems. And it's specifically this that has kept things like the PSP and the DS and even 3DS like alive long term, is that the battery is easily swappable. So you, even when that original battery has failed, and many of them have at this point, it's easy to replace and you're going again. And yeah, some of them have had issues with swelling, especially the PSP. May or may not happen now. But again, it's replaceable, so not a big deal. But these modern devices, man, you're absolutely right. Taking them apart, getting to the battery, it's extremely fiddly work. Like tiny, tiny little parts, like small screws and very carefully placed ribbon cables and all kinds of stuff like that, which are not necessarily fun to put together, I will say.
Yeah,
I've done some, and even just Joy-Con replacements, they're not nearly as bad as the system, but it's not that fun to work on them, and it can be a bit of a pain. So being able to replace batteries like this makes these models awesome, and I would hope that they would just embrace this for the global hardware chain, right? I don't know if they will, but like, I feel like all new consoles sold, you should just do this replaceable battery thing, because it does make the hardware like better in terms of, you know, longevity.
Yep. There's also the potential to have more energy dense cells in there, so you could have longer battery life, for example. Although what I will say is that, you know, the story of third party bat fees that have actually failed a lot quicker than official bat fees. I mean, I've got a lot of sad stories to tell on that front, particularly when it comes to my Dyson vacuum cleaner. Interesting question from Teasing Hilarity. Howdy Foundryman, given Nintendo have to produce the EU replaceable battery model of the Switch 2, what do you think the chances they phase out the OG model and just go with the EU version everywhere going forward? While they may lose some sales from people replacing their worn battery OG units, they hedge against other jurisdictions introducing similar requirements, keep product lines and associated tooling, etc., to a minimum, and importantly, offer all consumers the opportunity to keep their devices going when the battery wears out. Well, you know, that's going to be a decision for Nintendo to take, but they're quite specific at the moment that it seems to be a particular variant, I believe, as opposed to like a sort of global rollout. This EU legislation, there's a lot of stuff in there that's pretty good. For example, the glue that's used to, like, you know, basically keep batteries in place, a nightmare when it comes to actually fixing these things. That's not allowed. And similarly, they need to supply replacement parts for 5 years after the final device comes off the production line, which again, I think is pretty cool. Oliver, what do you make of all of this?
Yeah, I think this is pretty good. I think the primary change here will be getting away from the glued batteries, which is very common in consumer electronics nowadays, to ship devices with glued batteries as opposed to screwed in batteries or batteries secured through other means. Which is great because right now, if you have a Switch 2 unit and you want to replace the battery, I think you basically have to soak it in isopropyl alcohol to get the adhesive to be removed. And then you can remove the adhesive and then you can stick another battery in there. But it's kind of a process. This should ease up that whole process considerably if they do move towards screws and pull tabs and easier methods of removing a battery. That would be great. I would say that most Switch 2 users won't need to replace the battery, hopefully. But definitely, if you do use your Switch for extended periods or for a very long time, right, over the course of a decade plus, you need to replace that battery, this is going to be a really good solution for those users, and it's going to enhance the durability lifespan of Switch 2 units in the wild, which is great. I'm not sure they're going to do this for the whole world because I think it is just cheaper, simpler, to use glue, and possibly you can also fit in a slightly higher capacity cell as well, just because you don't need to have the kind of associated like tooling and marks and areas needed to screw down a battery. You can actually have those be filled with battery because glue does not really require nearly as much space and things like that. So yeah, I would assume this will be EU only, but I wouldn't mind having a screwed in Switch too, even if it had like marginally lower battery life. I think that's a trade you'd be perfectly willing to take for much easier serviceability down the line if you do want a new battery in your Switch 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to be interested to see who else follows suit on this, but certainly the concept of replaceable batteries is a good thing. Speaking of devices where the battery hasn't gone great, for me personally, the original Steam Deck, I didn't use it for some time, and I actually found that while the battery life seemed on the face of it to be okay, the device would occasionally just shut down during play randomly. Mm-hmm. And I think it just wasn't delivering the requisite power anymore, which wasn't great, right? But, you know, those devices, the PC side of things, certainly it's quite easy to remove the back, at least, and to get at things. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but the Switch was definitely a lot more difficult. I kind of want to take a look at this new version. The legislation comes into force February next year, I believe. So I'm curious as to whether we're going to see it sooner rather than later. Anyway, let's move on. Okay, so somehow the RTX 3060 has returned. This has been rumored for some time. The concept that NVIDIA is going to bring back a five-year-old graphics card to address issues in the supply chain. We actually now have evidence that it has actually happened. I mean, Oliver, you talked to NVIDIA in CES, I believe, to say these rumors true. And they basically said it never left production, which I couldn't back that up at all. I couldn't find 3060 for sale in the UK. 3050, on the other hand, I think is fair. That,
right.
That did seem to still be there. But a company called Manly, M-A-N-L-L-I, not the traditional English spelling or meaning, they have actually released a new 3060, apparently. It seems to be, the good news is, it's the 12-gigabyte model, 3,584 CUDA cores. Looks like standard specification 3060. And they've released, unfortunately, a 6-gigabyte 3050. The original was 8 gigabytes, so obviously they've cut down the memory interface there, reduced bandwidth. I'm going to be interested to see whether any more people actually bring out a new, a quote-unquote new 3060, and the extent to which it will actually proliferate in the market. I think at this point, I'm kind of doubtful if it's going to sort of get a sort of wide-scale re-release unless it is super cheap to make, because, you know, in the UK, you can pick up a 5060 8-gig model for, I don't know, about £260, which I think is pretty good value, certainly in the current climate. But, Oliver, I'm just kind of curious what you make of this whole situation. It's kind of bizarre to resurrect a 5-year-old graphics card, isn't it?
Yeah, the specific comment that you received from NVIDIA at CES was that, like you said, these cards had never left production, which I'm not sure how to square that with the fact that I don't really see any 3060s for sale at the moment. But apparently there are new cards coming from Manly, and there's also a report that some limited supplies will be coming from apparently colorful Asus, MSI, and Galax, according to a rumor. So that's an interesting outcome that apparently was reported by Video Cards a little bit ago. about a month ago. So I will be curious to see what happens. I actually think these cards are a good match for the needs of modern games, actually, because they combine decent performance with 12 gigabytes of frame buffer, you know, and good ray tracing performance and things like that. So they're not quite at the level of like a current generation console necessarily in terms of rasterization performance, but they are just about there in terms of the performance that you need for modern games with enough frame buffer to back it up, right? And run your high settings, high hair, high textures, whatever, run Indiana Jones with no great worries or quarrels should be fine. So that's very positive in my view. But yeah, I am curious to see where this goes. I'm not entirely sure where this supply is coming from. Maybe Nvidia had some spare parts. You never really know with supply because Nvidia could be producing cards and they could be holding onto them. They could have a back stock of cards. We don't really know what the production status is on these 8-nanometer cards from Samsung, right? Who knows what's being produced at what times. But I actually think this is not the worst line to come back with the needs of modern games. I actually think this 3060 12 gigabyte model has aged quite well. Now, 3050 6 gigabyte model, I don't think has aged nearly as well, unless you need like a device that does not use external PCIe power, right? It's still quite good for a device that does not use PCIe power, but 6 gigabytes is not really good for anything but esports these days. 8 gigabytes is really the minimum you would want to be at for current gen AAA software, and then 12 gigabytes is much, much more comfortable, obviously, for modern games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John, what do you make of this? I mean, here's the thing, right? I mean, it is 5 years old. We should be considering it obsolete, and yet 12 gigabytes of RAM, that's a very, very good thing. You've got DLSS, obviously, which is, you know, fantastic technology. It works. And it may not be as powerful as a PlayStation 5 GPU, but you've got better upscaling. And, you know, obviously developers are trying to address like 1440p to 4K resolutions with PlayStation 5 via upscaling. And the 3060 might be weaker, but, you know, chances are it's going to be addressing 1080p and 1440p screens. So I'd say that if the price is right, there's actually good reasons to bring back the 3060. I mean, you know, it still performs reasonably well. You know, it's not as if the feature set has disappeared. It is still supported via driver updates. It is like number one or number two in the Steam hardware survey. So a lot of people are using these cards. I mean, if you're going to bring back some older GPUs, there are worse contenders.
Indeed. I just think it's funny that we can now pair a 3060 with a newly re-released 5800X3D. And you build a it's like building a retro PC in the modern era. I mean, it does kind of feel like the requirements on games have kind of settled into largely like a, I don't want to say a rut, but we've reached a point where even those older GPUs are still viable, which it's interesting to reflect on. It's probably good in terms of like value for customers. Like in the early days of 3D cards or the 2000s, like you could never imagine like a 5-year-old graphics card still being viable in the face of new releases, right? Mm-hmm. Like just no way. But obviously times have changed, and given the cost of components, I mean, it's one way to go about it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just checking your dates there, and you're quite right. There's a 13-month difference, I think, maybe 14-month difference in the release date between the 3060 and the 5800X.
Yeah. I remember them being a bit contemporary. They're usually, if you get a 5800X3D, you would have a higher-end GPU, but still. They're both aged hardware.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we just need to wait and see what the proliferation of these cards is going to be. But, you know, there are worse options. But similarly, we've had rumors this week, and actually Will talked about it on the website, about the fact that the 50 series Super, Blackwell Super cards with more memory may actually be launched next year, being announced at CES 2027, I guess. And that would kind of like be a good thing. There have been rumors for some time that there was going to be a 9 gigabyte version of the 5050. And then there were rumors there's going to be a 9 gigabyte version of the 5060. Right. And the way that that actually becomes a thing is that instead of having 4 memory ICs on the board, you have 3, and those 3 have higher capacities. The problem being that obviously you're losing memory bandwidth because the bus is curtailed. Now, it kind of made sense for the 5050 because they were going to swap out GDDR6 memory for GDDR7, which is basically twice as fast. So even though you've lost bandwidth on the bus, you're gaining it from the speed of the memory ICs. That product never seemed to come out, and I kind of think that's a bit of a shame. And similarly, then the rumors of the 9 gigabyte 5060, you would have lost performance on that because it's already got G7. But you would have had an extra gigabyte of memory. And what we've been seeing recently in terms of optimized settings for 8 gigabyte cards is that 8 gigs is kind of not good enough, but it often seems like 9 gigabytes might be good enough. So I was really hoping to see that 5050 9 gigabyte come out, because it effectively offers 4060 performance, which is okay. But then you've got just a little bit of extra memory that would potentially allow for those higher quality textures to come into play. But obviously, if there is going to be a 5060 Super that's 12 gigabytes, well, happy days. It is kind of odd, though, Oliver, that, you know, extra memory being offered, when there's a memory crisis.
Yeah.
But I guess obviously it's down to the supply of these 3 gigabyte memory modules, and maybe that has improved.
Yeah, and maybe, I mean, with some of these products, you don't really know what the specifics of the memory market look like. Like, maybe there's a bit more supply for G6 modules for this RTX 3060. Device, like, maybe that's actually viable to ship something with 12 gigabytes, or maybe they just have the allocation already bought and need to fill it somewhere. You know, who knows exactly. But yeah, I would really hope to see the Super Series, and if not the Super Series, then just something using these 3 gigabyte modules, because that seems like a really good way to allay some of these memory pressures that are facing modern games. 8 gigabytes is not so comfortable in a lot of modern games. You really have to go down in terms of the settings. You don't really want to be in a scenario where you're at a worse memory capacity relative to consoles. I think historically speaking, that's actually not been a good way to go. And I think we're seeing that this generation. But like you said, kind of the pressures in terms of supply and pricing pushing you completely in the other direction are really not too attractive at the moment. So I do hope we see that Super Series, though, and I do hope we see these 3 gigabyte module GPUs hit the market soon, because they seem like a good mix for the current range of rendering challenges, where maybe we're not so pushed on bandwidth, maybe we're not so pushed on compute or ray tracing capability, but we just need more frame buffer with these lower-end GPUs to be really comfortable.
That's the point you've come up with quite a lot, John, which is basically, hey, today's hardware is actually pretty good. You know, do we actually need new technology at this point?
I think about that a lot, especially on the high end, right? Like, it feels like Nvidia put all their effort into hitting the 5090 and they're like, okay, that was too far. You gotta back off. You know, and it just, we've kind of been, everybody's been settling for a lot less. Like, it's weird how the market has changed, and I guess the part shortage has a lot to do with it. So in the spirit of that, Rich, when you go to a computer shop or even like Amazon or something, I still see a lot of cards like the RTX 3050, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I even see the GTX 1660 around.
Man,
do you want to know what card kind of slots around that era? You know, that maybe it's time to bring it back. Say it with me now. AMD Radeon R9 Fury X. Wow. It's time for the revival, baby. The 11-year anniversary.
Ah, oh, dear. You've got an interesting obsession with the Fury X, haven't you, John?
I do. I love the Fury X.
I'm still harboring. I mean, my sort of review of the Fury X, it was one of these situations where the card comes in for review, and you have to keep benchmarking it because the results aren't as good as you think they're going to be or have been promised. And, I distinctly recall AMD saying it was going to be an overclocker's dream, and it was unstable when I added 50 megahertz to the to the core. It's kind of like, you know, it happens a lot. It happened with the 1970 GRE recently, where my review was a day late because, you know, it just didn't make sense. None of the results I got in made sense. It just looked like poor value. Why would you release a poor value when the press deck is coming up with, you know, value scenarios which make it look great? You know, you start to doubt your own sanity. But what I will say is that pretty much in each and every time that this has happened, that the numbers are the numbers, and it's just not a particularly great product.
I got to say there, Rich, looking at the relative performance, according to this chart, the RTX 5090 is 785% faster than the R9 Fury X.
Man, crazy stuff. Okay, let's move on to our final news topic. Well, it's not a news topic as such. Obviously, we now have via Will Judd a website that tells us what we were up to 1 year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. There's a lot of E3 stuff in there this week, perhaps not surprisingly. But John, you highlighted that it is 5 years ago that AMD released FSR1, which is one of those periods of time, one of those pieces of content where, you know, you say things that actually are true, but people just don't want to accept it. And you end up getting hammered on social media and stuff like that. Poor old Alex had a bad time of it back in the day with FSR1 because he told it, you know, he told it how it was or how he saw it. And it turns out that it is a pretty basic upscaler and not particularly great. And better things were to come from AMD. I mean, five years on, we're on FSR4. The gap has been closed with NVIDIA effectively, but it certainly wasn't 5 years ago.
Oh, yeah. That was an interesting time because people were, and rightfully so, looking for an answer to DLSS 2. Because let's remember, DLSS 1 from 2018, not good. But DLSS 2, by that point, was excellent, especially for the era. And FSR was sort of rumored to be AMD's, like, sort of tackling of this whole, like, upsampling thing, right? But as we would later learn, it really was never intended to be that. It was not a product that could compete with what DLSS had become, and it wasn't built to do that either. And I remember when Alex was first looking at it, he was just like, what is going on? This is really bad. Mm. Like he was not impressed. And it also forced him to play a lot of Godfall, which is a game nobody talks about anymore. If you remember, it was the era of Godfall. And that was, I guess, one of the first games to support it, but it turned out to just be a spatial upscaler with sharpening, essentially.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be until... Yeah, FSR2 is when they actually made the leap, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a leap there, but even then, you know, FSR2 was being called a DLSS killer, and it was a gigantic improvement. Let's be clear here, but it wasn't a DLSS killer.
No,
and in fact, you know, FSR4 has come along, and it's quite interesting that while the quality is there, I don't think anybody's calling it a DLSS killer anymore, even when it's got the greatest claim to actually being, you know, comparable technology. Really, really bizarre stuff.
It's good, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Oliver, you'd think 5 years on, FSR1 should be far away in the rearview mirror, but it's not, is it?
No, it's not. And indeed, with some of these Nintendo titles, we tend to load up when we look at the IP notices in those titles, is we often notice SMAA, very common anti-aliasing technique that Nintendo likes, but also FSR1 is very commonly named in those titles. Nintendo in particular loves to use FSR1 to upscale their games. Capcom also still likes to use FSR1 quite a bit with their RE Engine titles. I think it was used in Pragmata, as well as Resident Evil Requiem, two very recent RE Engine titles, which I think is interesting because perhaps the biggest problem with FSR1 doesn't really have to do with its actual quality. I think it just has to do with kind of convincing developers, in some cases, hey, here's an alternative way of upscaling your game where you don't necessarily need temporal upscaling, because I think temporal upscaling almost universally produces a better result. And some game engines, like the RE Engine, are very capable of supporting it, right? But for some reason, on PC and on consoles, Capcom and other developers seem to prefer FSR1. Maybe it's a little bit easier to work with, but for whatever reason, they stick with FSR1 and produce results that just aren't good enough in those titles. But I do think it's an acceptable upscaler for spatial upscaling, as long as you don't view it as a DLSS alternative, which is unfortunate because that's the way that AMD was marketing it at the time. They were marketing it as, here's our alternative to DLSS. It wasn't remotely close to the quality of DLSS at that time, and obviously it isn't now. It does also tend to produce kind of a certain stereotyped look to imagery that I don't really like necessarily when you look at it closely. It tends to smooth out edges, it tends to round out edges and produce almost kind of a slightly painterly look on the final image. Can depend on the resolution of the source content and what you're upscaling to, but oftentimes it produces a little bit of an ugly looking image, I would suggest. And in those cases, I'd prefer a bilinear upscale. Honestly, I don't really need this kind of very artificial looking final resolve in my computer software. So I think it's been not so successful. But, you know, looking on the bright side, I think FSR2 is a big improvement. FSR3, still a further improvement on the analytical side of things. And then FSR4, FSR 4.1, and the enhanced version of PSSR, those are all greatly improved versions of this kind of upscaling family that do produce a meaningfully improved image with the full detail you'd expect from a high resolution image. So there's been a lot of improvement in this space, but it's unfortunate in 2026 to still have to talk about FSR1 as a contemporary piece of rendering technology because so many developers continue to use it. And I don't think it's the right solution for most titles.
Yeah, it was a particular pain point in Pragmata and Resident Evil Requiem, mm-hmm. to the point where you kind of wonder why Capcom did it. It's kind of a bit weird there. Yeah, I mean, there were some good things about it, right? You know, open source. Yeah, that was something that AMD was very, very heavily invested, still heavily invested in, but obviously FSR4, I'm not sure of the extent to which ML stuff there can actually transfer to other GPUs. But, you know, FSR2 obviously gained a lot of traction across many, many systems. So, you know, that was a sort of useful legacy, so to speak. But, you know, all paths seem to be converging now on machine learning, although, you know, there are still some pretty impressive temporal solutions out there. Yeah. I guess that's all we really got to say about that one. Any final words on that one, John?
It's become a bit of a scourge, and I wish that Japan had never been made aware of the existence of FSR1.
Wow.
A lot of those developers are the only ones that seem to hang on to it when there's just better, less ugly upscaling solutions that are just as cheap or cheaper
right
out there.
Well, it's very, very cheap. That's the thing. I think that's the reason Capcom are using it. It was in Hogwarts as well.
Hogwarts Legacy used FSR1, yeah, quite a bit. Now, on the PS5 Pro version, it uses PSSR1, which then you can upgrade to PSSR2 using the override. But yeah, it uses FSR1 mm-hmm. in all the console versions, which does lend it, again, a bit of that kind of painterly look. You can kind of spot it from a mile away once you're trained on it. You can really spot that heavily upscaled FSR1.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, back in the day, some of the pushback against Alex's analysis was, it, you know, he did an image quality analysis and he wasn't particularly concerned about the frame rate boosts that you get. And you did get big frame rate boosts from FSR1 because it doesn't do much and it's effectively running the game at a lower resolution, right?
Yes.
And Alex wasn't particularly concerned about that because that wasn't his particular focus. Alex is like, well, it's so super PC centric, but I can tell everyone here that he just doesn't care about benchmarks that much. You know, it's
he's interested
in the experience. I remember there was, I think it was when we did XESS. We had the first look at XESS upscaling, gave it a pretty good review. But Intel were asking me, how can we make sure Alex isn't going to benchmark the card because it's not out yet? And I'm sort of saying to them, look, Alex has no interest in knowing what this precise benchmarks of your new GPU are whatsoever. He's really is focused on the experience here and what XESS is delivering. But yeah, I mean, interesting to see what the DF Time Machine is bringing up here. It's a website that we'll put together. And just wall-to-wall E3 stuff otherwise, going back 10 years, Zelda Breath of the Wild, Wii U E3 frame rate test. Those frame rates weren't great from what I remember. And we were looking at Days Gone on PS4, E3 demo performance. wasn't great. It got a lot better. Yeah, crazy stuff. We shall continue with our retrospectives, though, because we really enjoy going back and revisiting some of those older stories and sharing some of the anecdotes from back in the day. But that is the end of this particular episode of DF Direct. Hope you enjoyed it. Like, subscribe, share if you did, ring bells for whatnot. DF supporter program, patreon.com/digitalfoundry. Early access to the Direct. That's great stuff. Early access to various stuff when available. Ad-free website, ad-free video downloads, high-quality video downloads, lots of great stuff there. But that's all from us on this one. Thanks for watching and supporting Digital Foundry, and I guess we'll see you next week. Cheers.